This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
So, as part of this December edition, I have the honour of being in conversation with the Jodfather himself, Dr. Stuart Lowe. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Dave. It's really bizarre.
It's a bit strange being on the other side, isn't it?
It is. I vowed I'd never be interviewed for the Jodcast. I might live to regret this.
Well, let's just go back a few years. You've been at, or you were at Jodrell for quite a while, and your work was with Planck. Well, eventually with Planck, but can you take us through what led to that?
After finishing my PhD, I then was trying to find something to do. I wanted to stay in astronomy, and there was a job going at Jodrell, a job working on Planck and doing instrumentation, which was similar to the things I'd been doing during my PhD. Within about a month of starting, I was then given the opportunity to go and spend about 3 months in Italy over the summer of 2006.
Oh,
so this
nice.
Was a little bit after having just started the Jodcast.
I remember it well.
Yes. I think I even phoned in from Italy a few times.
Yes, you did. Yes. I remember those first few transcontinental ones. I think we had Nick in New Zealand. And
Tim in South America at one point.
That's the one, yes.
Yep.
Yes.
I then worked on the low frequency instrument of Planck and helping to calibrate the instrument, and had a really good time in Italy during that summer, when people from all around Europe, and in fact some people from America as well, all descended on northern Italy to help test the instrument, and that was a really good time, and we got lots done. It's amazing how much work goes into making spacecraft able to be launched and to work in space, because you can't go there and fix them. So you have to make sure that everything's covered, every eventuality, and you've tested your instrument as well as you can and made sure it works as well as it possibly can. So,
and of course, those kinds of the workshops have to be absolutely dust free, don't they? Because any little bits of
very clean rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So after the summer of 2006, I continued working on the instrument. We then integrated that instrument with the rest of the spacecraft. So there was the high frequency instrument, and then that was integrated with the whole spacecraft. So you've got all the bits that control the spacecraft. You've got the solar panels to provide power and things like that, and the mirrors themselves. And then that was all tested. So in the summer of 2008, we spent a few months in Belgium. It seemed like every waking hour, and our waking hours were fairly random. Because a test would be scheduled for 9 in the morning, and it wouldn't happen at 9 in the morning, and you'd be waiting for something else to finish or to work, and it would probably be like 7 in the evening before that test started. And then you would have a shift of, say, 8 hours or something. So the days were either long or very, very short. There were some times when you'd arrive at 9 in the morning, having been only awake for an hour or two, and then be told, oh, go back to bed because your shift starts this evening. Now, so it was actually, even though it was rather demanding on your body in keeping up with this very confusing schedule system, it was actually a lot of fun. Everyone was there in this place in the middle of a forest, basically, on the outskirts of Liège. We were having meals there, and everyone got to know each other quite well, so we had quite a lot of fun.
Yeah, sounds it.
And then after that, we had all the lead up to launch last year, which was quite nerve-wracking for everyone. After all these years of work, some people have been working on it since the early 90s. I've only been working on it since 2006, but some people were there nearly 20 years. You were hoping it would all launch successfully and not just be still attached to the bottom of Herschel and not be able to do anything. So that was quite nerve-wracking, and I did lose a lot of hair last year. In just the combination of trying to keep all the Jodcast going and still do all the demanding work around Planck. So we had a few months in the summer last year after launch, while Planck was going to this point in space, L2, which is a million miles on the other side of the Earth to the Sun. During that time, we were cooling down the spacecraft and the instruments. The coldest bit of Planck goes down to 0.1 Kelvin, which is extremely cold.
Yes.
If people don't know what that is, that's about minus 273 degrees Celsius. So it's very, very cold, and you need that to make the instrument work really well. So everyone was testing the instrument as it was cooling down, making sure that all the currents and voltages were all correct on all the instruments, and that it was performing as well as it could. And then the first sky survey started in August last year, And they've now done two full sky surveys.
Yes. Now, in between all of this, in between all of your Jodcasting and Planck, you've also been working on a few projects of your own, such as Chromoscope.
Yeah, so I like to play around in what's called my spare time. One of the things I've had a long interest in is seeing the sky at different wavelengths, having done lots of radio astronomy and working on Planck, which is at microwave and radio wavelengths. You spend a lot of time trying to imagine what the sky is actually looking like if you had radio telescopes for eyes, and comparing that to the different other wavelengths of light, so optical light or infrared or ultraviolet or X-ray. And so one thing I wanted to do was have a nice way to change between different wavelengths, because there are sky surveys at pretty much every wavelength, every major band. They're of different depths and different amounts of resolution, the detail you can see in them. We've now got gamma ray surveys with Fermi that was been doing that in the last year or so. Planck has provided a new map of the sky, which WMAP had done, but Planck has gone to higher resolution at microwave wavelengths. We've had optical images of the sky for years, so I wanted to have a nice way to go between all of them. And so I basically remade Google Maps and made it so you could change the wavelengths just by dragging a little slider at the side and just fade between things. And actually, it's been a lot of fun just to see how the sky varies.
It's a very, very good little piece of software. And it's available in multiple languages as well.
It is. I've been really lucky. Astronomy gets people involved from all over the world, and through combinations of professional astronomers, PhD students, amateur astronomers, people have volunteered to translate that into quite a few languages now. I think we've got Gaelic, Welsh, Swedish, French, German, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian.
In pirate yet?
We haven't got a pirate translation, no.
Oh, right, okay.
So if anyone out there is fluent in any language that we don't yet have, then please do get in touch. It's great to have it in different languages.
Yeah, very much so. So going on from there, just to wrap up the interview, can you tell us what you're doing now?
Well, I had a little bit of a change, and I've headed slightly away from radio astronomy and gone to work for an optical observatory, the Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope, which is a network of telescopes spread around the world. People in the UK will perhaps be more familiar with the name Foulkes Telescope, and the Foulkes Telescopes are part of the Las Cumbres Observatory. And Foulkes is the name of the project in the UK that goes to UK schools and gets them involved in using the telescopes. So I've gone into the optical domain, which is quite scary for a radio astronomer in some ways. I'm sort of involved now in a bit of education and website-related things, and I've only been in the job for 2 months, so I'm still finding my way around, but I've been basically making the observations that come off the telescope a bit easier to search through and to find your data. So I'm trying to make all that nice and then to link into various techie things such as linked data and things like that.
Because this astronomical data is notoriously complex, isn't it?
It is, and there's a lot of astronomical data, and there are a whole load of people around the world involved in something called the Virtual Observatory, which is trying to make it easy to share astronomical data, and the databases of which are only going to get bigger and bigger in the coming years. When things like the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, the LSST, come online, we'll be getting basically real-time, almost video of the night sky. That's how it'll be compared to now. They'll be constantly imaging the sky and putting huge amounts of data onto the internet. There's going to be a slight problem of having people to analyze that data.
Do you think then the future for astronomy is going to be along the sort of Galaxy Zoo model or the SETI at home model of actually letting the public go through and take a look for things?
I think there's definitely going to be some of that. Some things you can do by computers, and it's just much better to do it by computers. There are some really, really boring things that are very easy for computers to do that nobody is really bored enough to do as a person. So you would get a computer to do all those things, but there are some things that still computers can't do, which Galaxy Zoo are showing us how you can get lots of people to contribute to the project of doing science. So there's definitely going to be things like that. Even in Las Cumbres Observatory, there are some ideas about future plans of doing citizen science projects. So I think citizen science is going to be an important part of astronomy in the next few years.
In that case, thank you very much for coming along onto the Jodcast. It's been a pleasure to have you. And we wish you all the very best in your new job and in the wonderful, weird and wacky world of optical astronomy.